You are listening to Raising the Bar with Konasek and Dillon. Join us for a lively and informative conversation on hot legal topics. Call or email us with your legal questions at raisingthebar@wgnradio.com.
Welcome to the Raising the Bar Show. My name is David Hochberg. I am in here with two attorneys from Konasek and Dillon. Their names are Mike Hannigan and Tom Long. Just adjusting the volume, I'm sorry. How you doing, boys? Doing all right?
Good, good, David. Thanks for having us.
First time on the radio? First time? You're okay?
Yeah, it is.
Feel good?
Absolutely.
No oxygen? We don't need the respirators? We're okay?
Not yet.
All right. Raising the Bar Show, sponsored by, brought to you by Konasek and Dillon. Phone lines are open, 312-521-8600. 312-521-8600 is the phone and text line. This is the weekly show here on WGN.FM. Regarding legal matters and legal topics and your rights as citizens. And the topic of today's show is, are we safer traveling? One hell of a week, boys. I mean, nurses with Ebola traveling to Cleveland to check out the Rock and Roll Museum, people coming off of tarmacs in hazmat suits, and some dudes with a clipboard, like the clipboard's going to protect him. What's going on? Are we safer doing anything anymore? Walking down Michigan Avenue, tourists all around. If somebody sneezes, do I have to run over to Northwestern Medical Hospital in order to get some treatment? Mike, what's up?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I think it's more about whether we believe we're safer or whether we actually are safer. I think that the distinction is whether the world is safer and we are better protected by our government, or whether we just think we are or are led to believe we are. And I think that that's an interesting question, because I don't think there's a real answer to measuring whether we are actually safe. So I think we're dealing with a government whose job it is to make us at least perceive ourselves as mm-hmm. being safe. And I think that's an important job for the government. And I think they've done pretty good with it since 9/11. They can certainly claim that we haven't had any other incident or problem in 13 years, and therefore we're safer. But we all thought we were safe before 9/11, and look what happened.
Right. So, Tom, 9/11, we let terrorists on planes with pocket knives and screwdrivers and whatever. On 9/12, we couldn't bring in anything greater than 3 ounces, and we basically had a cavity search before entering a plane. Are we taking it, in your professional opinion as an attorney for 32 some years, are we now have to ratchet it up? What happens now? 3 ounces this, double scrub, put your arms up and they could see you naked in the Gravitron machine at the airports now. Where do we go from here?
I think where we're at now is probably where we need to be. You can't go much further and still have the ability to travel effectively. Right now, it's difficult enough to get through security, to get to a plane, to get from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. If we do anything more, such as scan more, body searches, pat downs, things like that, which is really all that's left,
right?
Nobody's going to get through the airport. Transportation, as we know, will come to an end. So we have to accept what we have now and hope that does it.
Okay, so I'm going to throw it back to you, Mike. Phone lines are open if you have any questions about, are we safer today traveling than we were yesterday, last week, last year, or back before 9/11 happened. 312-521-8600 is the phone line. 312-521-8600 is the phone and text line. Mike, you've been an attorney for 28 years. You graduated from the college, Chicago Kent College of Law. You're a pilot and former flight instructor, so you've got a little bit of history on this. Airport screenings. Where does the common sense come into play, and where does Gestapo 1936 Germany come into play? I mean, how do you split the two? You got to keep, as Tom was saying, you can't shut the damn system down because our economy will crash. It's not 1901. We have to fly places in order to transact commerce and to get from point A to point B. What do we do as a society to protect ourselves from just the entire system cracking down, but somebody walking on a plane with looks like a cold, but can take out the whole East Coast?
Well, I don't think we can really do much to protect ourselves. I think with regard to airline safety, we really place our fate in the hands of the government and the airlines to take care of that for us. And, you know, I think that it's been 13 years. It's kind of hard to remember what it was like before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
But we've certainly lived with what it's been like since 9/11. And I think screening is here to stay. I think it's an important preventative measure. I don't think it would be fair for us to think that we are 100% safe because of the screening measures that are being taken. I think the common sense issue really comes in with when you're standing in that line for an hour waiting to be screened, 13 years after this process started, and you're scratching your head asking yourself, how is this going to prevent some terrorist from taking over my airplane? And that's what we have to look at. And when you see people, you know, this day and age, when 45 years ago we put a man on the moon mm-hmm. and brought him back alive, and now we still have to take our shoes off at the airport and run them through a separate machine.
A little crazy.
From the one we stand in. Why right. isn't the one we stand in testing our shoes as well as the rest of us?
Right.
So, and why are we taking people's flip-flops off to determine whether they're made out of C4 or some other kind of explosive? I think that we really have to question, is it all necessary? And the answer to that for me comes with a real simple hypothetical. If you were given an opportunity to take two identical flights to the same destination that leave the airport at exactly the same time mm-hmm. and arrive at the destination at exactly the same time, one of the aircraft, everybody gets screened the way they're being screened today. The other aircraft, you can show up at the airport 5 minutes before the flight, go right to the airplane, right to the gate, board the airplane, and not get screened. Which flight would you be on?
The one that you'd have the scrub down with, right? Or, well, you know what? But they're doing preliminary scrub downs if you pass a pre-check, which I think we need more of, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like an I-pass lane.
Exactly. Listen, I went in there. I had, unbeknownst to me at the time, I was coming down with pneumonia when I went into the TSA at that time at O'Hare at the international terminal. And I cleared it. I bypassed it. Unbeknownst to me, I had to get all my kids to pass it as well. And my wife, I just figured, one, you blow through, you got to get the whole family. But let's talk about profiling real quick, right? 312-521-8600, 312-521-8600. I want to throw it back to Tom. You've been with Konasek and Dillon for almost 3 years now. Out in the Geneva office, not the Galena office. I you know, during the first show, I mistakenly said in Galena. But when you do open an office in Galena, I will be there cutting the ribbon, by the way. You've been an attorney for over 32 years. You went to undergraduate University of Notre Dame, Loyola University and Chicago School of Law. You're probably going to be tied up this Saturday with a football game, I think, about 6:30. Start the pregame festivities.
Absolutely.
Right? All right. So I think Notre Dame's got a football game against Florida State, something
like
that.
Yeah, some small school.
Small school in Florida State school, never heard of before. 312-521-8600, 312-521-8600. Driving down the street in Highland Park, cops pull over an African-American. That's profiling. Driving down the street in any street, in any town. I bring up Highland Park because they got nailed a couple of years ago for profiling, and other cities, not just Highland Park. Profiling passengers, is that against constitutional rights? Is that, you know, I'm an African American driving around in an affluent white suburban area, and the cops pull me over because I'm a black teenager? Okay, how do I judge profiling at airports or at train stations to see if you've come down with some infectious disease that's going to take out the entire train and drop the plane out of the sky?
Well, I think with the medical aspect of profiling, it's much more difficult. Again, going back to what I said earlier, people have to get on planes. If you've got a sniffle, you can't be precluded from getting where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
But where is the line drawn? What is reasonable in terms of them being the government, the security staff? What can they do to check to see you have Ebola or something contagious? I don't know. I'm not a medical guy. I don't mm-hmm. play a doctor on TV either. But how can you tell in a relatively minimally invasive or time-constrained situation if somebody's got a contagious disease that should preclude them from traveling? To me, that's really a difficult question that I don't know how you draw the line and figure it out, but still have the mobility and rapidity you need to travel. I don't know if that's profiling. If someone's coughing, you know, I cough a lot. I have, you know, acid reflux, so I cough.
Right.
If I'm coughing in line and someone freaks out and they pull me out, I'm going to be unhappy. That kind of profiling would bother me. But the other kind of profiling, I think that's the nature of the beast in security. And again, it's a fine line, and you got to rely on the people doing it to put aside any prejudices, biases, and just look at people whose conduct and appearance fit a situation where I'm going to take the time to look at that guy.
Do we have to start manning the terminals and the train stations, not with bomb-sniffing dogs, Mike, but with nurses and doctors and medical students? Because who better to determine if you're carrying pot than an undercover cop that sells narcotics, okay, or a bomb or drug-sniffing dog? I mean, do we have to now start having RNs walking around with thermometers and swabs and everything, all our major airports? I mean, it'd be a great boom for nursing, okay? It'd be a great job creation, come to think of it. But, you know, where does it come into the right of privacy and the right of safety and that balancing act? I mean, it all comes down to a balancing act. And, you know, how do you not cross that balancing act so somebody hires an attorney like you to say, my rights were violated, okay? I had a little cold, but I was locked in a detention center until I had, you know, not only my temperature taken, but I'm sure they called the NSA and got all my medical records, as if that's not all public record for the right people. And but how do we split up the privacy versus the safety rights again?
Well,
it's a tightrope. It's a Walenda Act.
And I'm not sure we're there yet with one case of Ebola, now two down in Texas in the United States. It could become a problem, and I think we might be inviting it on ourselves the way we're sending people over to West Africa to try to fight the crisis over there. It's going to end up bringing it back here. But I don't think we're to the point where we need nurses at the train stations and nurses checking people's medical records, and hopefully we won't get to that. Hopefully this will be dealt with before we get to that point. But I think the whole profiling issue is an interesting issue, and the whole balancing of rights issue is an interesting issue, because I have no problem if somebody is trying to save me from someone who's trying to kill me, wanting to find out as much information mm-hmm. as they need to protect me. So I don't mind being screened as long as the person who's screening me is doing it in a way that's designed to protect me. And I'm not sure that anyone's privacy rights should trump 300 and some other people's rights to being safe on an airplane, especially when the measures, in my opinion, are fairly minimal. The inconvenience and the half an hour you might spend going through a security line in order to board an airplane. I just don't think it's asking that much. When we start getting into medical issues, I don't know. Maybe we will have to be medically tested. Maybe part of what we will have to show in the pre-screening process is we don't have any medical conditions that are going to become an epidemic in this country. But I think we're going pretty far afield on that. With regard to profiling for terrorists, I think it's more important for us to detect them and prevent it than it is to say, whoops, we probably should have checked that guy.
Yeah. And I'm sorry if you look like a terrorist. Guess what? You have a mustache and a beard, and you had a certain face contour and a certain profiling, and you look like somebody that is on the 100 most wanted list. Guess what? You're getting pulled from the line, and I really don't care. Okay, and if I have to buy you a cup of coffee because you're pissed off, guess what? Sit down, okay, and let the authorities do what they want. 312-521-8600, 312-521-8600. You're listening to the Raising the Bar Show, brought to you by the law offices of Konicek and Dillon. That's KONICEK Dillon, DILLON, law.com is the website, for three W's, Konicek and Dillon.law, KONICEK DILLON, law.com. You can send your emails, all your legal questions, to RaisingTheBar@WGNRadio.com. That's RaisingTheBar@WGNRadio.com. So, Mike, as long as we're on railroads, one of your specialties is railroad litigation. Now, does that include the people that like to walk in front of 1,000-ton trains and unfortunately die when that happens? Don't quite understand what their thinking is. I understand that we have lots of going on, but you're standing on a train platform, and you have a train that's 5,000 times bigger than you, and it takes a long time to stop a train, okay? Just like it takes a long time when to stop a car when you hit the brakes, it takes a lot longer to stop a flipping train. I think it takes a football field to stop a train at a certain speed. But what type of litigation on railroads are you specializing in?
Well, I've done that. I've handled several suicide cases where mm-hmm. someone decides that somehow it's the railroad's fault that their loved one stepped in front of a train. And also pedestrian cases where pedestrians aren't trying to step in front of trains but end up in front of them and get themselves injured or killed. It's a serious problem. Obviously, the family of the victim is the real victim in this case.
Sure.
But, you know, the lost victims in these cases are the crew. I've dealt with crews on trains that have hit cars, hit people.
They're a mess.
It's an emotionally traumatizing event for a train crew to have hit and killed somebody, and you never hear about it.
Yeah,
nobody talks about it.
I talked to an engineer who was involved in an accident like that. He said somebody just walked right in front of him. He's doing 60 miles an hour, and you know there's no way to stop. And he never went back into the engineer seat. He went to the conductor. He became back in the back of the train where he stayed. Stamp the tickets and collect the money and answer everybody's crazy questions, but he could never drive the train again. Mentally he was done. So how do you go about, let's take a little different angle. I know we were supposed to talk about the dangers of trains, but if you're two different aspects, right? Number one, your loved one was killed at a train station because a train hit them. Okay. I was tied up in Des Plaines 6 weeks ago. I got caught on the other side of that accident where a pedestrian was struck by a Metra train like 5:15, and I was on the wrong side of the train track, and it was just they shut the entire city down, okay, because it was an accident site. What happens? Take us from my loved one gets struck by a train, intentionally or unintentionally, and where do you go for something like that?
Well, the railroads are governed by the federal Railroad Administration and the Federal Railroad Regulations. They're governed with respect to what they do and how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
Trains don't sneak up on people.
Right.
Trains don't, it's not a surprise that a train is coming. Usually they have lights, whistles, horns, and there's some sort of warning device.
It's also called railroad tracks.
Lights or gates.
Right, so it's called railroad tracks on the ground that you would look both ways.
Right. The train can't swerve to miss you.
Right.
If you're in front of the train, there's nothing that crew can do except throw the train in emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And in the unfortunate cases where they hit somebody, it's investigated, and that's why everything is shut down for as much as 2 or 3 hours now to fully investigate the railroad accident to determine whether or not it was the person who was hit's fault or it was the people operating the train and or the trackage and signals fault. And I've seen both. I've seen instances where equipment has failed, where someone hasn't gotten a fair warning. And it clearly is. There is responsibility or liability on the railroad's part. And I've seen instances where the railroad's been doing everything exactly the way they're required to do it by law, and somebody ends up trying to beat the train, whether on foot or by car.
Mm-hmm.
And in that instance, the railroad still gets blamed. They still get sued. They're mm-hmm. the so-called deep pocket. But, the families go through hell, and it's a very tough situation to deal with. And it's made even tougher in our society where people just don't like trains. Nobody likes to wait for a train.
Right, but it's better to wait for a train and let it come instead of sticking your head out to look for a train. You know, because there's an announcement. I don't take the train a lot. You know, the train is approaching the station, right? They say it like 15 times, and I'm like, all right, I get it. Then I'm thinking somebody's probably going to look down to see where the train is and get their head taken off. That probably what happened. That's why they have to do it 15 times. We got a text message here from Sean at the 630-312-521-8600 is the phone and text line. Is there any liability against an estate when someone commits suicide by train?
Liability against an estate. I can tell you from the defense side, and I spent many years defending railroads as opposed to representing families whose loved ones get hit by trains. There have been instances, it's pretty rare, where the railroad will bring suit against an estate, suit against the car owner or his insurance company for the damage to the train. It happens very rarely. I think that the railroads that do that are inviting counterclaims against them by the estate for, mm-hmm. The death of the person. But in a clear suicide case, if you shut the railroad down, you're costing the railroad tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they're able to keep track of that. And
is there any way that the railroad's just going to be like, I can't take this anymore, I'm just going to write a check just to shut these people up and make them go away? Or are they just...
Unfortunately, that happens more often than not.
Oh, that's too bad. All right, 312-521, I hope we answered your question, Sean. 312-521-8600, 312-521-8600. Okay, I'll throw this one out to you, Tom. silence versus safety. Okay, you know, we get back to that. That am I inconvenienced waiting in the half hour line at 5 o'clock in the morning to go on vacation, and have to take my shoes off for some unknown reason when it's 50 below out, leaving Chicago and getting to 70 degrees. I love that 120 degree swing, by the way, in the wintertime. It always fascinates me. Silence versus safety. Okay, the constant battle over train horns, the warning horns, which are pretty dang doggone loud, and the neighbors that oppose them. And my thought is this. Just call me crazy.
Scares me.
Yeah, right. I know. You're fastening your seatbelt because you have no idea what's coming. But it goes into the conversation we just had about the train tracks, right? If you see the train tracks and they're in pretty good working order, that means that they're maintained because there's trains coming over that, right? And the railroads have been around since the early 1800s or whatever, and it's been a girl, it's 1700s, 1800s. It's been a great way of moving product and people around, and it was the launching of the great economic boom here in the United States, right? The Iron Horse. That's why we made it all the way out west, and that's why we have grown as a nation. My thought process is, if you're buying a home near a train track, shut your mouth. You're buying a home near a train track, of course there's going to be horns, especially if you're by a crossing. And guess what? At 3 in the morning, when your bedroom starts rumbling, all right, you put it by a train track. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think the train moves? It just moves during the day? They move freight at night, of course. So what's the debate there? Silence versus safety. Where do we go with that?
I think it comes down to an issue of reasonableness. Obviously, the train, as we've discussed, is going to win any sort of confrontation with a car, truck, or person. So sounding a horn when you come to a crossing is generally a good idea. I don't know if anyone has a problem with that. In the middle of the night, when there's no one out, should they still sound a horn if you're living 100 feet from the tracks? Yeah, probably, because there's still people out, and cars are going to cross, even at 2 in the morning. The question becomes, how long did they sound it?
Right.
How many times did they sound it? Things like that. That, again, is a reasonableness factor where you give warning if there's anybody stumbling around at 3 in the morning, as opposed to hitting the horn 4 times and shaking people out of bed. I live within hearing distance of trains in the middle of the night, and I do get a little ticked off when I hear the horn go on for 30 seconds straight, thinking, this is 4 in the morning. One toot should be enough. So it's a reasonableness factor where you take into consideration people who not just live right on the tracks, but a block away. You're going to hear that at 3 in the morning.
So let's take a different aspect here. Train derails, okay? We have a train derailment, and you're within shouting distance of the train derailment, which means that when the train derails and it's carrying some type of toxic, obnoxious fumes, and it gets out, right? Because a train never derails, right? It never happens, right? Right. You know, it happens probably once a month on some type of scale, and a couple of times a year on a grand scale. Okay, trust me, it happens more than once a month, because I used to be in the scrap industry, and there were entire companies that went around the country picking up pieces from tipped over railroad cars. Okay, but let's say you're a couple of blocks away, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and instead of a 30-second horn that's ticking you off, all of a sudden you wake up to some disgusting spoiled egg, rotten egg smell, which if something smells like rotten eggs, it can't be good for you, okay, most of the times, let's say. And all of a sudden we have some type of biohazard medical spill or something like that. As a citizen, and I get sick, does Conasecond Dillon represent me in that type of train crash?
Well, I would think the situation would be, again, what was done when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
If the railroad does nothing or very little to contain the problem, arguably they created, presuming they created it, and with good lawyering, sometimes you can always pin the deep pocket.
It's always their fault.
But that's what it boils down to. Sure, if a chlorine tank comes off the track and the gas escapes and the railroad goes, we'll worry about that tomorrow, and someone gets sick, absolutely. But you got to, again, maybe I'm beating a dead horse, but reasonableness. You got to react to the danger in a reasonable way. And if you don't, they're going to be responsible for it.
And how do you prove that they don't? Mike, how do you prove that the railroad company, ABC Railroad. And if there is an ABC Railroad, I apologize. I'm just using ABC Railroad as an example in this conversation. ABC Railroad is trucking down the track. Something happened. Tracks went bad. Something went bad. Here, I'll give you a perfect example. Northbrook, Illinois, Glenview, Illinois, 5 minutes from my house, 10 minutes from my house. People are driving to go see a movie, and the overpass that the train, they were going under a train track, and the train, the bridge completely collapses. Okay? You've got cars everywhere. They didn't find the bodies until 2-3 days later when they started digging out from underneath the bridge and removing all the scrap and all the entangled car crash. Okay?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that one, actually, Dave. That was a coal train. Dumped a load of coal on a car with two people in it.
Yeah.
I think one of them was a lawyer. In fact, they might have both been lawyers.
4th of July weekend.
And, you know, that's a situation where the investigation, and just like with airplane investigations, the National Transportation Safety Board and the Federal Railroad Administration get involved, and they take control of the accident scene. And you look to determine what caused the train to derail. Was it something that the railroad did wrong? Did they fail to inspect equipment? Did they fail to inspect the track? Now, tracks and equipment, they change with the weather. You can have a rail crack.
Oh, sure.
And there's nothing you can do about
steel
it. You
fatigue,
don't know it,
something like that.
And you
like
don't
that.
Know it until you're over it.
Mm-hmm.
And the railroads are typically responsible. They're responsible for the rail. They're responsible for the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones who get sued more often than not when a train derails. And it's very difficult to prove that they're not responsible. But there are instances where you can show that it had nothing to do with the manner in which the railroad operated their equipment and their rails. They did everything that was required of them. Everything checked out. And whatever caused the derailment, I think in that case it was a washout from a pretty bad rainstorm a night or two before. Of course, then they get accused of having not detected it or determined it soon enough to prevent the derailment. So,
and we had a super hot summer that summer. Okay, the temperatures were off the charts, and I think they said something that the rail started warping because of the heat and whatnot. You know, the excess heat. And a couple of months before, there was another derailment, or a year before, there was a derailment close by that same location. Not the bridge went out. But, you know, if you do something crazy on the bridge with all that weight, it doesn't take much for the bridge to give way if you've got weight going off the rails 5, 10, 15 feet, 100 feet, 200 feet ahead of it. You put undue stress on that bridge, then you've got crime scene going on there, right? Because you got dead people, two people, a couple of days later, you don't even know we're dead. How do you even put your arms around that if you're a family? I mean, you know, you guys do that all the time, but how do you even start that conversation? Hey, you know, I need some legal representation. Where do you even start? You know, your parents disappear for 2-3 days, and now they're found crushed in the back of a car because you had 5,000 tons come down on top of them unexpectedly. Where do you start even putting something like that together, a case like that together?
Well, that's a case where you want to get in touch with the lawyer sooner rather than later. It's important in a situation like that a lawyer get involved and preserve the evidence at the accident scene, a lot of which will get destroyed or torn up in the process of getting the railroad back up and running, which is a priority for the railroad. So you want to get a lawyer involved. You want them to take the proper measures to get into court and get an order that the railroad preserve anything and everything that could be evidence as to the railroad's responsibility or fault for the accident. In that situation, you know, the most important thing, obviously, is for the family to get themselves grounded and go through the grieving process and the rest of it. But you do, as difficult as it might be and as much fun as people make of, you know, the ambulance chasers and the people whose first cell phone call is to their lawyer rather than their doctor.
There's a purpose.
Yeah, there is a purpose for it.
You serve a purpose. And it's an important purpose because you're never going to get your loved ones back, and you want to make sure that not only are you taken care of financially if there's a family involved, but you also want to make sure it doesn't happen to other people so they don't have the same grieving that you have when somebody passes away driving underneath a train track when 5,000 tons of whatever drops on them. 312-521-8600, 312-521-8600. We have a text coming in that we'll get to after the break, gentlemen. We have Michael Hannigan and Tom Long in here from Konasik and Dillon. You're listening to Raising the Bar Show, sponsored by Konasik and Dillon here on the G. 312-521-8600, phone and text line if you want to reach Konasek and Dillon directly. Their phone number in Geneva, Illinois is 630-262-9655, 630-262-9655. Raising the Bar at WGNRadio.com, Raising the Bar at WGNRadio.com. For all your legal questions, we'll be right back.
Raising the Bar, brought to you by Konasek and Dillon.
Welcome back to Raising the Bar Show. I'm David Hochberg in studio with Michael Hannigan. You've been with Konasek and Dillon for over 10 years, working in both the Geneva and the Chicago office, 28 years worth of experience, graduate of Kent, Chicago Kent College of Law, pilot and former flight instructor. How cool is that? So am I, but on video games. Tom Long has worked at Konasek and Dillon for almost 3 years in the Geneva office. Have you guys eaten at the Mexican restaurant across the street? Delicious.
Yes,
absolutely.
Delicious fish tacos. Wendy Listig, who's in here as well, our sales rep at WGN. She's a very sloppy eater, but it was a very, very wonderful eating experience. And you've been an attorney for over 32 years, graduate of the small college in South Bend, might have heard of it, Notre Dame University. You also went to Loyola University, Chicago School of Law, and you're a big Irish fan, Fighting Irish fan. So don't bother you tomorrow at 6 o'clock. You're going to be in your man cave. You've been at Konasek and Dillon for a little bit here, and you represent lawyers in legal malpractice and ethical matters. So let's talk about that, okay? 312-521-8600 is the phone line and the text line. We have a quick text question here. We'll throw this out from Brian. How much can airlines be responsible for? Question mark. They screen an infected person, and an infected person still gets on an airplane. Is the airline liable or the government for not getting the screeners the right screening equipment? Who screens people before they get on Metro? Thank you, Brian.
Several questions there.
We'll pick one.
I think it's a reasonableness standard. How can you hold? Why does anybody have to be liable? Somebody got on an airplane with a disease that nobody knew they had. I don't even know if the person who had it knew they had it. I don't know how you detect it. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't know how you would detect it at an airport through a screening process when the lab tests take several days, if not weeks, to come back. And with Ebola, it's my understanding you have to be tested twice before you can determine you have it. So to suggest that somebody should be liable for not detecting that a passenger had Ebola sounds a little out there for me, but pretty typical of our litigious society. It's always somebody else's fault.
You damn attorneys. And we can't live with them, can't live without them. And we wouldn't have a show without them, we wouldn't have the show. You want to add something to that?
Yeah, just after 30 years of doing this, the reality is accidents do happen. Just because something bad befalls somebody, someone didn't necessarily do something wrong.
Right.
That's life.
All right, so we have a 630 with the comment, airport security, why doesn't the U.S. adopt more of the security measures that Israel uses, which basically talks to every single passenger before you get on the plane? Because I went to Israel. I flew LL one time. And why are you going? And they're reading you, and they're scanning you. And you know they've been through big-time training to, you know, try to trip you up. And I was just going for a vacation. They asked me 7 or 8 questions, and you know, the same question 7 different ways, and thank God I passed it because I'm Jewish, but I really don't want to go through a Mossad check, if you know what I mean. So let's get to ethics, and let's get to your specialty, attorneys defending attorneys, okay? I have a situation. I see a shrink, right, because my wife wants me to, so to make everybody happy, I go, right? Whatever. So I'm sitting there with the shrink, and I'm like, you know what? I want you to come on my radio show to talk about the psychological impact of people have for not calling due to financial distress. Because I own a mortgage company. I talk to people all the time. I had a guy call me today. Yeah, I've got a sale on the 22nd, and I'm calling for help. Okay, what? December 22nd, November 22nd? No, October 22nd. Oh, okay, you got 5 days. So I wanted her to come on to talk about the psychological impact of why people wait until the end, until they're bleeding out, to call a doctor to stop the bleeding. And she said that she went to a board of attorneys, her ethics board, quote-unquote ethics board, and they said, because I am going to see her, that it's unethical for me to have her on my show to talk about something that I think is vital to a lot of people out there to get through to them like, hey, you're not a failure. It's, you know, maybe it is your fault, but you know what? You're making it worse by not doing anything. And the attorneys in her ethics panel that I like to meet and slap every one of them because I think they're idiots. That's just me, said it's unethical for her to do that because of our relationship and that she'd have to fire me as a client and wait 3 years to come on my show. And I'm like, I just want to talk to a shrink. It's to help people not to continue to do what they do. Please help me understand that.
Well, let me ask you this, Dave.
I'm not on any medication.
I'm a little confused here. Is she a shrink or a lawyer?
She's a shrink, but she has an ethical panel that she goes in front of.
And they're made up of lawyers and not other shrinks?
Other shrinks and 30 lawyers.
Okay.
Yeah, it must be a great time.
Yeah, 30 lawyers in the same room.
Yeah, and they meet once a month, and they talk about ethical issues. And I'm just like, wow, that should be just an absolute blast. You guys must really go crazy. What do you break and play war, right? You whip out of cards and you see you know who's got the aces in their hands. So talk to me about that. I don't understand that. Does that make any sense to you?
The only thing I could think of is they're attorneys who specialize in medical ethics.
Right.
And if there's a problem with you and your doctor conversing on air about your problems.
It's not my problem.
Well, if it could segue into that, and in a situation she may divulge something inadvertently just in the byplay about your treatment, these lawyers are probably telling her, not a good idea because Dave's a good guy. But he could be pissed off if you say something about him on the air accidentally and come after you. So, best case scenario, don't talk about confidential matters on the radio.
But again, it doesn't make sense to you either. It doesn't seem like.
I'm not a medical ethicist, but I would think
the only way that she could get probably in trouble.
To me, it sounds that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to help people out to get through to people. Like, you know, just give them a smack in the head to say, hey, you know, you're drowning.
Get another doctor.
Right.
Doesn't treat you.
Well, that's what I said. I said, give me somebody. Yeah. So whatever. Okay, so let's talk about doctors. You represent, not doctors, you represent attorneys being sued by their clients because they don't think that they represented them properly. And you also, there's another subsect of your practice where you go after other attorneys that a client comes to you. Perfect example. Mike, I hire Mike. I don't think Mike did a good job. Okay, Tom,
never happened.
But in this 1 in 4,000 occasion, I don't feel he did a good job. He probably did a great job, but I just don't feel I was properly represented. Tom, you're working at a different law firm, and I would go to flip it around. You're at Connacic and Dillon. Mike's at a different law firm. Mike represented me at on a case that I didn't think that Mike represented me right. I call Tom up in this example. And I start talking to you. There is legal ramifications, and there is a legal right of me as a consumer to talk with you and the attorneys at Connacic and Dillon to review my case because maybe Michael at the other law firm he worked for didn't do a good job. Talk about that. You representing people that come to you to investigate if their attorneys did the right job, and also you also represent the attorneys that are being sued by guys like me if I don't think that I did the right job. So talk about both sides of that table.
From the plaintiff's side, where you're coming to me looking to sue Mike, you know, the first step is getting all the facts. Whatever the scenario was that Mike was representing you in, I would have to know the facts and the context in which Mike did the work that you're unhappy with. If he drafted a will you think was wrong or he didn't handle a personal injury suit right, I get all the facts, and then I look at them and say, should this have happened? Should the end result, case gets dismissed or you lose in court, why did that happen, and did it happen because of something Mike did or did not do? In our world, there's something called a standard of care. Lawyers in a particular field, be it personal injury, contract, real estate, bankruptcy, all have a standard of care that reasonably well-qualified lawyers in that field do. And you look at what happened and compare it to that. And if I don't know that field, I get on the phone and I call someone and say, hey, I got a client who called me about this. This is what happened, X, Y, and Z. Was that right? Should Mike have done this? Shouldn't he have done that? Should Mike have even had the case? And that analysis goes forward. And once you get the feel that something Mike did caused you harm, you move forward with the suit. And on the defense end, you flip it up, flip it reverse. Case comes into me. First thing I do is look at it and say, okay, what are they saying Mike did wrong? And did that cause whatever Mike did cause what they're trying to recover for? And again, if I don't know the law in detail relative to that case, I find an expert to tell me, here's what happened. What can I do? Did Mike mess up or is this nonsense? And defend him to the ninth degree. So it's kind of an evaluative process framed within what would a reasonable lawyer do in the situation Mike was put in with the facts you had.
And the attorneys that call you, Mike, in this example, you're now work at Conis. You're now the Mike at Conisic and Dillon.
I'm not defending myself.
You're not defending yourself. When you had to defend other attorneys against a suit that came after them because their client didn't think they did right, how do you protect your client? What do you do? Is it a long, drawn-out process? Do you, walk us through that part of it.
It doesn't always have to be a long, drawn-out process. If your client did make a mistake, it's always best to acknowledge it and to determine whether or not somebody was harmed or injured by the mistake that the lawyer made. Lawyers are people. We all make mistakes.
Sure.
And more often than not, I find that lawyers get themselves in more trouble by trying to cover up, hide, or fix their own mistakes than if they just would have acknowledged it at the front end and called us sooner. But in any event, we find out what happened. And if we did something wrong, we try to fix it by making the other side whole. What did my lawyer's mistake cost you at the end of the day, if anything? It's a very interesting field because, say, in an automobile accident case where you're in an automobile accident, Dave, and you hire a lawyer and he doesn't file the lawsuit by the statute of limitations deadline, and now you lost your lawsuit against the driver that hit you because of your lawyer. Now you sue your lawyer for what you would have gotten had he filed your lawsuit on time in a timely manner. So you not only are you trying the conduct of the lawyer for missing the statute of limitations, you're trying what we call the case within a case, the underlying automobile accident lawsuit, to determine what would have happened and what you would have gotten had the lawyer not made a mistake. And it's very interesting, and it ranges all aspects of the legal profession, from mergers and acquisitions that go bad to real estate deals that go bad. We see a lot of legal malpractice cases coming out of divorces where nobody's ever happy and the bill's always too much.
Yes.
Yeah. But that what we do is we look at what did the lawyer do that we're defending and did it cause someone harm? And if it didn't, then no harm, no foul. You don't owe anything. There's things that lawyers can make mistakes where nobody gets hurt by them. They're able to fix their own mistakes, or we're able to come in after the fact, or somebody's able to come in after the fact and fix the mistake before it actually harms or causes injury to the client.
That's why you guys carry errors and omissions insurance or something to that effect, where I was on my radio show, somebody talked about a real estate transaction that went bad. And the attorney at the time admitted to making the mistake. He's like, you know what? You're right. It was a Friday. I was going to a Bears game. I had to go. I was in a rush. I remember the closing. He fell on the sword. He absolutely fell on the sword. So there was no need for a lawsuit. Well, I guess the other side hired an attorney to represent them. And the other attorney stood up and said, you're right. I made a mistake. Here's what happened. I'll sign whatever you need me to sign. My insurance, place a claim with my insurance agent. Guy never made a mistake in 30 some years. Things happen, right? You get a little sloppy once, costs you whatever. That's why we carry insurance, right? And if people are like, well, that's crazy. It's just like car insurance. On 18, you get at 16, you get your driver's license, you pay insurance. God willing, you don't ever have to use it. When you're 55, 60, you get into an accident. After 40 years, boom, you have to do it, and there you go. Okay, so it's the same exact thing. You guys have insurance to cover these things, and that's why you need to be properly represented in that, because I don't want to go against you guys. I do loans and host radio shows. I'm not an attorney. And the attorney would pay your fee, right? Isn't that part of the settlement and something like that? Or am I reaching too far there?
Legal malpractice plaintiff's case, or like anything else, there's a percentage fee in most of them. Some are hourly, but generally that's the case. And, you mentioned insurance, and that's reality. Lawyers are human. Some people don't believe that, but we are.
Yep.
And you're going to make a mistake, and you own up to it if you made it. The question becomes, what happened? Is it no harm, no foul? That's really second part of what we do.
You're listening to the Raising the Bar Show, brought to you by Conisic and Dillon. Conisic and Dillon, you hear them all the time. Tom Dillon, very nice man. He records all of the commercials. You predominantly hear them talking about nursing home care and nursing home negligence and that stuff. And we're doing the show so you can understand and meet the attorneys at Conasick and Dillon and realize they're a much bigger firm than nursing home care and nursing home abuse. And yes, that's important, but we also have railroad reconstruction experts here. We also have malpractice experts here. You guys have got a history, 30-some years experience, each one of you guys, into different aspects of the law. And that's why the show is important. You need to learn about the law and learn about your rights. Raising the Bar at WGNRadio.com. Raising the Bar at WGNRadio.com. Go to ConisecandDillonLaw.com. That's K-O-N-I-C-E-K, Dillon Law. .com, K-O-N-I-C-E-K, law, DillonLaw.com. So, Tom, we got a couple minutes left. During the break, we were talking about medical malpractice, and we were talking about Joan Rivers, may she rest in peace, and how now that the medical report has come out and all of that stuff, now everybody is an expert, okay? And there was some concern about swelling in her throat and what you can do and not do. In a couple of minutes, the people that are interested or think they were involved with medical malpractice, what are a couple of things you could leave them with?
Well, in a case like that, obviously whenever there's a bad result medically, there's dire consequences, not just monetary. Somebody's in trouble. They die or are injured. And it becomes a very emotional issue for the survivors or the victims themselves. So from a litigation point of view, you got to look at whether, again, the standard of care. Should what happened have happened if everybody did what a reasonable doctor in that position did? You know, we were talking about the Joan Rivers situation, swollen vocal cords in a situation where they're sticking a tube down your throat to look for something. That seems to me, and I haven't seen the records, and I don't even play a doctor on TV. Maybe I am on the radio now.
You look like one.
But
you look fantastic, by the way.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
But swelling of vocal cords when a tube is being passed down your throat should be an expected consequence or complication that could have been and should have been addressed. But again, we're an older lady who's had some work done. Let's be honest. Maybe that complicated things.
Yeah.
But the bare bones of it seems there's an issue, but the reality is you got to look beyond just an injury and see if what caused it was something that could have been prevented or shouldn't have been done.
Okay, so you get a copy of the medical report. What do you start doing? You're not a doctor. Do you bring in a doctor to review it? Do you have a team of doctors to look at it? I mean, where do you go with that?
Plaintiff's lawyers who specialize in medical malpractice, plaintiff's work, have a stable of doctors in various specialties
mm-hmm.
that when a client comes in with a particular case, they know who to go to and say, hey, take a look at these records. Is there anything here that indicates a problem occurred relative to the care? And again, first step, if there's nothing there, again, mistakes happen. Doctors are like lawyers. You have a problem. It isn't always their fault. And there are lawyers who know doctors who go to them for straightforward opinions.
And you don't have to die. I mean, it can be something went wrong in the, you know, they left a sponge in there. You know, we've heard numerous, I don't know how you lose sponges in people's bodies, but, you know, things happen, right? You know, now they've got everything numbered, right? And they check it out and they put it, and they're like, okay, we used four sponges. Where the hell are the sponges, right? We're not disclosing anybody up because people die from that.
I had a case with sponges years ago, and you think they're all got radioactive little numbering, little tags. How do you miss one? Who knows? They did. Again, they're human, but you can't let that happen. And I was helping defend that one, which was a little problematic, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
In those kind of cases, you kind of look towards, okay, we messed up. What was the harm? Another surgery, a little pain and suffering, that sort of thing.
Oh, so you represented the doctor.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Is it safe to say that the hospital and the doctor now have procedures for not leaving sponges? I swear to God, did we ever talk about this
before
right now? Okay, that's crazy.
There's always been procedures, but sometimes in the ER, things get missed.
Wow. That's
maybe not be comforting, but that's, again, we're dealing with humans, we're not machines.
But everything turned out.
Everything turned out fine.
Opened him or her back up, took out the sponge.
All good.
Did a little whatever you need to do.
As a defense lawyer, was perfect. She was perfect afterwards.
Thank God. Okay, because of that. Whoa, that becomes a, yeah. Wow, see that? We're talking trains? I had no idea that you represented people with trains. We started getting train text messages. All right, Mike, you got a minute? You got a minute before we take off. You want to leave us with something wise and profound going into the weekend?
Well, I'm not a very wise or profound person, but I can say that I think people need to be patient, and especially with the airport security issue. And unless we're all going to start flying naked, we've got to be screened.
Well,
we've got to go through security. And they're trying to do their job to keep us alive, and we need to be patient with it.
And you'd have to make sure that those are leather seats that are easily cleaned.
plastic covered.
Yeah, plastic covered. It gets a little uncomfortable. Tom, you want to leave us with something in the next 30 seconds?
I think when everybody argues about competing rights and what we need to do to protect ourselves, touchstone's reasonableness. We got to expect inconvenience in our life just the way the world is with technology and information flow. It's only going to get more complicated, and we've got to act reasonably as best we can.
Deal with it.
Bingo.
Just deal with it. You have been listening to the Raising the Bar Show, brought to you and sponsored by the law offices of Konasek and Dillon. If you want to reach them by via the website, it's Konasek and Dillon, KonasekDillonLaw.com. That's K-O-N-I-C-E-K, Dillon, D-I-L-L-O-N, law.com. If you want to send them your legal questions, if you have any questions about this show or any previous shows, send them an email, raisingthebar@wgnradio.com. raisingthebar@wgnradio.com. If you want to reach the attorneys at the law offices of Konasek Dillon Law, you can call them at 630-262-9655, 630-262-9655. Yes, nursing home is one. Nursing home abuse, that's what you hear. Yes, it is important. It is a big part of their business in their offices in Geneva, but they do a lot more. We just talked about safety in traveling. We talked about safety in hospitals. If you're an attorney, you need representation too. The law offices of Konasek and Dillon do that as well. So if you want to learn more about it, go to KonasekDillonLaw.com, send emails to raisingthebar@wgnradio, and give them a call at 630-262-9655. Boys, have a great weekend. Go ND. We'll be back next Friday.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.